Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. The legislature will pick Utah's new congressional map on October 6th, and then a judge will weigh in. Utah needs to address these seven issues to optimize growth after the 2034 Olympics. And Utah workers felt sick after an X-ray lab opened next door. Then they checked the drywall, which was supposed to be lead-lined. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune political reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Good morning. Yes. Outdoors reporter Julie Jagg joins us. Thank you.
Appreciate you having me.
Thank you. And reporter Peyton Harkins is with us. Thanks, Peyton.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll start with Robert Gerke. Of course, big news, and this continues to develop. Robert, maybe very quickly, tell us how we got to this, how we got in this pickle. The legislature, on a very tight timeline, is having to produce these maps.
Yeah, yeah. So we've talked about it on the show before, but in back in 2018, voters passed the Better Boundaries Initiative, or commonly known as Proposition 4. It was aiming to change the way we do this redistricting process every 10 years by creating an independent redistricting commission, setting some standards for how the boundaries are drawn, including prohibiting partisan gerrymanders or drawing the boundaries to benefit one party over the other. The legislature passed Senate Bill 200 that followed in 2021, and basically that undid key portions of the of that Better Boundaries Initiative, including repealing the ban on partisan gerrymandering. So the plaintiffs in this lawsuit, which is the League of Women Voters, Mormon Women for Ethical Government, and a group of individuals sued, saying that the maps that the legislature adopted that created four safe districts were unconstitutional. Basically, one of the key arguments was that by repealing this Senate or this 2018 ballot initiative, the legislature had violated citizens' constitutional rights to change and reform, alter and reform government through the ballot initiative process. So the Supreme Court agreed with that last year in a unanimous decision and said, you know, that if that ballot initiative right in the Constitution is to mean anything, the legislature can't just undo it willy-nilly, and they need a good reason to do it. That got sent back down to the district court last month. Third District Judge Diana Gibson said, based on the Supreme Court ruling, Proposition 4 is the law in Utah, and the boundaries that are drawn have to be drawn in accordance with that law. And so the boundaries that had been in place since 2021 were no longer valid. They were void, and kind of sent the legislature back to do it again. So we're on a tight time frame because we have to have the legislature, as you mentioned at the outset, has to have a map submitted to the court by October 6th, which is 9 days away now. 9 or 10. So the legislature is kind of rushing through this process. They held two public meetings this week to take public comment, and they released five maps that the Republican majority on this redistricting committee drew. And there was also one additional map that was drawn by the two Democrats on the committee. In addition to that, there's 4 or 5 dozen maps that the public has submitted for consideration. And like you said, the legislature has to come up with one of these by October 6th. There'll be a special session on October 6th to formally adopt it. Then it gets submitted to the court, and the judge will look at that map and decide if it complies with these guidelines that are in Proposition 4, including, again, the partisan gerrymandering provision.
So there's a lot of discussion on the committee about communities of interest and how they define that. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. So this is a term of art in the redistricting world. It can be either considered narrowly or broadly. You know, it's generally speaking, if you share interests with, you know, your neighbors or a racial demographic or the way the legislature is defining it, there's military installations. They consider those a community of interest. Tribal reservations, they're trying to keep those intact, and a couple others. And so that's one of the standards that they're looking to with these maps, and one of the criteria, I guess, that they're judging best map against. So their expert that they've hired looked at the five maps that he drew for the legislature. He said these maps keep communities of interest intact. They're also trying to avoid, carving up cities or counties. Cities get the first priority. They want to keep those intact. They want the districts to be relatively compact because, the thinking being that the representatives have to travel around the district. It's hard in Utah because there is so much rural territory to make them very compact, but they want them to be as compact as possible.
The public did weigh in, right? And in fact, the several members of the public submitted maps.
Yeah. There were, I believe, as of yesterday, close to 60 maps that had been submitted by members of the public. And then during these two public hearings that they had, both on Monday and Wednesday of this week, probably about 45 to 50 people testified, gave comments during those hearings. In addition to that, there's probably close to about 900 comments that have been submitted publicly on through the redistricting website. They'll be accepting those public comments up through, again, October 6th. And so if the public is interested in weighing in, they can go to redistricting.utah.gov. And there's a link there where people can submit the maps and provide their input. They are in kind of an interesting situation where the co-chair of the committee, Senator Scott Sandel, said, even though they're taking these public comments, they can't really make any changes to the map because under the district court's order, the way they're interpreting it, at least, if they make changes to the map, that's considered a new map and would trigger a new 10-day comment period. So they pretty much have to adopt one of the maps that's been posted on the website. He also said they're likely not going to pick one of the public maps, to be frank, because there is this ban in Proposition 4 that prohibits them from using partisan voting data in creation of the map. And he said that there's no way for the committee to know if the public, when they drew these maps that they submitted, if they used partisan data in those without going in and taking depositions from the people who submitted all 55, 60 maps. So he thinks that's impractical. So it seems like they're pointing toward picking one of the six maps that have been submitted. And frankly, the map that the Democrats submitted kind of got torn apart by the Republican members of the committee. And since they are the majority, I think it's the likely outcome is that they'll go ahead and pick one of the five maps that they released on Sunday over the last weekend.
So many will want to know, I guess, especially Democrats, but everyone. In fact, that's headline of another story. Will Utah's congressional districts be more competitive with the legislature's new maps? So what did you find?
Yeah, so using some internet tools, we can break down to the precinct level how the people who would be in these districts voted in recent elections. And so I took seven recent elections and looked at the new boundaries. And it turns out all six of the maps that were submitted create one district that would be at least competitive. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to be a Democrat advantage, but it means that there would be a tight contest. Frankly, there was one district out of the five that the Republican majority, the five Republican majority maps, that actually leans just slightly, but less than one percentage point, in favor of the Democrats. Others that would be within a couple of points, a couple percentage points, and The key part of this is under the current maps, there were basically at least a 20-point advantage to Republicans in each of the four districts. It was heavily tilted in Republicans' favor. So while it's not a guarantee that Democrats are going to win, it at least provides a possibility that one of Utah's four congressional seats will shift to a Democrat. That's pretty important, especially right now when nationally there's this big battle going on over redistricting. The Texas legislature's trying to redraw their boundaries to create five safe Republican seats. California's retaliating and trying to do the same thing to create five safe Democratic seats. Other states are getting into the fray because the House, the U.S. House, is so narrowly divided that going into the 2026 midterms, those could likely, well, they certainly will determine which party controls the House. And the party that controls the House is, you know, has a big role in how much of the Trump agenda gets implemented. Plus, you know, if Democrats take the House, they have investigative powers, oversight powers, where they can, you know, subpoena people from the administration. And they would also have the impeachment authority. Articles of impeachment always start in the House. And it's possible that the president, who's already was impeached twice during his first term, could see that in play again.
It's interesting, your analysis here. Some of these maps would produce a essentially a toss up in one district, and then another district would be within about 10 points plus Republican, right? So a little more gettable for a Democrat, maybe in a wave election.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I believe it was option E, the fifth map that the Republican majority submitted. And it would create a district that I think is about, if I remember right, I don't have it right in front of me, is about 6 point Republican advantage, and another one that's about 10. So potentially that could be two seats that could be in play. And like you said, in an election where it shifts dramatically toward a Democratic opponent, or maybe the Democrats just field really good candidates that year. You know, and so it does potentially put a second seat in play. You know, it's again, that 10 points is still a pretty big hurdle to overcome, but about half of what a Democrat would have to overcome to win one of the Republican seats in this under the maps that have been in place since 2021. So it's going to be interesting to see how they do it. And I think I don't remember if I mentioned this, but after the Republican majority picks the map that it wants to pass and the legislature passes it, they have to submit it to the court. If the judge decides it complies with Proposition 4's criteria, then that will be the map that's used in the 2026 elections. If not, she's allowing the parties in the lawsuit and the litigation to submit maps as well, and she could pick one from those as well. There's also this other wrinkle that has been kind of thrown into the mix. On Monday, Senator Brady Brammer proposed legislation that would sort of lay out how the legislature determines if the maps are have a partisan bias. And the criteria he's decided to choose is a thing called partisan symmetry. It sets up this sort of complex formula to determine if the maps qualify or if the maps are unbiased. There's a lot of dispute in academic circles and among, you know, opposition and from the Democrats on the redistricting committee who don't like that as sort of the only criteria, the only yardstick that they would use. And so there's a dispute over that, because the way that Proposition 4 was written, and it just says, you know, that they should use the best available metrics, that envisions, they say, multiple metrics, multiple tests. And there are multiple tests that academics use to determine partisan bias. But Senator Brammer's bill, again, would narrow that to just this one test that there is some contention over and some suggestion that it's not a good measurement for partisan bias, especially when you have a state that leans so heavily Republican and only has four seats in play.
Finally, Robert, you have a story just today guiding the public on how best to comment. Comments for the next, 9 days or so before the legislature chooses one of these maps. What would you tell us in brief, how public feel about it?
Yeah. Like I said, they're taking public comments up to October 6th. You can go check out the maps at redistricting.utah.gov. There's another link on there as well that it might be a little bit easier, but you can pull up a copy of the maps, drill down, you know, put in your home address and see how the way the maps are drawn would impact you. You can add comments on, you know, down to very specific levels saying, oh, I think this city should be in a different district, et cetera. Then add your comment on the website. As I mentioned, we're talking probably over 900 now. I haven't checked it this morning, but as of yesterday, it was right around 900 Comments have been submitted. I would anticipate a lot more will be between now and October 6th. And the legislature has kind of done an interesting thing. As I mentioned, they can't take into consideration any partisan data, so they're sorting through these. They've asked staff to sort through these and pull out everything that deals with partisan data and screen those from them so they don't get that information. And so there's some other tips and pointers, I guess, on how to effectively comment. Because if you want to take the time to comment, you probably want it seen by the committee members. And so you can check that out at sltrib.com.
sltrib.com, and the article here, which has links and helps, is here's how to weigh in on Utah's new congressional maps. So find that article, and it'll help you. Robert Gerke has been telling us about this. So, Robert, thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. In a few minutes here, we're going to go to a break, and we'll be talking about this headline. Utah needs to address these seven issues to optimize growth after the 2034 Olympics. We'll be talking with Outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. Before we do that, we bring in Doug Thurgood, and very important news right now. We're in the last day of our fall fund drive, and we're about $30,000 away from our goal. That sounds like a huge number, but we're chipping away at that. And with the help of some great people who are putting up not a single match, but a double match. We have Sonia Manuel DuPont and Ryan DuPont, along with our Alberto Brusolara and Luciana Di Sabro. And they've both put up some money. And so your money is tripled today with your call to 800-826-1495 or upr.org.
Yeah, I mean, every dollar to UPR always goes very far, and now it goes three times as far as normal. So this is really the time. I mean, this is the last day of the fund drive. It ends at 7 o'clock, so you've got, I think, 9.5 hours left to be able to support us. And this is really the there's never been a better time. It's the last day. You've got this double match, so you have three times as much staying power. You know, you're also supporting the Utah Food Bank by having all donations have two boxes of cereal go to the Utah Food Bank because of our partnership with Post Consumer Brands. So you're doing so many good things by just, you know, taking that couple of minutes and going online or calling us right now.
Now, Behind the Headlines is your program, and I do hear from people that they love Behind the Headlines. This is the program. I'm kind of taking this personal, not in a bad way, right? but I'm looking to have a really strong response during this hour, and you can help us to do that. And of course, your money tripled, and you'll help us to pay for programs like Behind the Headlines. How can people reach us, Doug?
You can go online to upr.org, or you can call us right now at 800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Get on the phone, get on the website. Right now is the time to do it.
And we'll go to break. We'll have more Behind the Headlines right after this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Here's the headline we'll be talking about next. Utah needs to address these seven issues to optimize its growth after the 2034 Olympics. We bring in Salt Lake Tribune Outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So this is interesting. This is a report from the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. And we're looking at after the 2034 Olympics. That seems kind of far away. It'll be honest before we know it. But it's interesting. I guess they're looking at this because the 2002 Olympics produced or helped produce so much growth.
Right. Exactly. Yep. So, and you're right. It's that 2034 is going to be here before we know it. I think the countdown is on. The Institute is looking at it because the 2002 Olympics were such a economic and population driver for Utah. And so they kind of want to help, I guess, or take a look at ways that Utah can either set itself up for further success beyond the 2034 Olympics, or else, or the problems that it may face before that. But basically, the authors of the report said that they see the Olympics as kind of a deadline, and a way to get things done. So earlier, I guess, in the state, it's kind of a, yeah, like I said, deadline to move things, projects forward. And these are the things that they pointed out that they thought most needed our attention.
So they laid out seven advantages and seven pitfalls. I guess they could have chosen another number, but they chose seven in each case. So I guess maybe start with the advantages. What do they think Utah's advantages are here?
Yeah, I spoke to the institute director, Natalie Gochner, and that's what she was saying. She's like, I don't know why we picked seven, but that's what we're on. So, and most of the benefits are things related to the economy, which are things that have been widely discussed already. The list goes economic dynamics. Excuse me, as I can't say this word, dynamicism, and diversity. High household income, low poverty, upward mobility, widespread prosperity, and then the others have to do with the population. So, well-trained work and educated workforce, young population that's fast growing, and then a strong social cohesion.
So those are the advantages. I guess build on those advantages. Then they have the, I guess they're calling the troubling seven. What are the troubling seven? I guess we gotta solve these problems.
Yeah, those are the things that they're setting out as things that they think need a closer look. And they kind of run the gamut, actually. One is housing affordability and homelessness, the traffic congestion, which we are all probably too aware of. Some of the more interesting ones with education are third grade reading proficiency and college graduation rates. And then they also looked at the environment with what focusing mostly on water in the Great Salt Lake, energy supply, and kind of whether we can keep pace. And then just kind of a greater like behavioral health, just basically a check-in on the mental health of the state and how everybody's doing.
Let's take a few of those more specifically, as you do in the story. I'm just quoting from your story. For example, in 2022, the legislature set a statewide goal of having 70% of third graders proficient in reading because it's a strong indicator of future educational success. So where are we at this point?
Yeah, and we are, that was, yeah, set in 2022, and in 2024, they were at 46.7%. So not, and that is honestly a drop of 0.1% from 2019, and it's the highest it's been since 2019. So that's not, we're not moving much, and it's not a great number.
What does the institute suggest that we do here?
So their suggestion is just to really focus. They said that third grade level is really important because it's going for people. Kids are making the transition from learning to read to reading to, sorry, from, yeah, learning to read to reading to learn. And so that's why they're really focused on that age group. So they suggested adding extra people into the classrooms, paraprofessionals, to just give the kids, I think, more one-on-one time or more concentrated time where a teacher can focus on helping them learn to read and be literate so that they can then, learn. Because they've shown, I guess, studies have shown that, if you don't learn in third, then it kind of deteriorates. Learn how to read in third grade, it deteriorates beyond that and causes problems down the
So,
line.
yeah. So for low graduation rates in college, the Institute is suggesting that we expand catalyst centers. What are those?
Yeah, so these are these like I'm not an expert on this for sure, but they are these centers that focus on transitioning, I guess, for kids from high school where they get credits in high school that they can then transition into college or into trade schools to kind of cut that time that they actually have to spend in college and kind of gets them on a career path earlier, is my understanding of it anyway.
So energy supply, one of the things the Institute is pushing is nuclear energy. So the governor is also big on this, I guess.
Right. Yeah. And I mean that was one of the things that they suggested of the many. Basically, this one was interesting to me because it's not they basically said it's not a problem, right? Like they said, Utah is really well set up to handle energy issues, and especially in an age that we're moving into with AI, where there's more energy demand. But they said, the real issue is just trying to manage it because some energy generating systems will be taken offline that have gotten older. Can we keep pace and can we diversify so that we can find different ways to keep pace? So that was kind of their issue there. But they did point out that they said that Utah's very well set up to be kind of a leader in that sector.
So I'm very interested to hear what the Institute has to say about the housing crisis. Probably don't have an overall, solution that's going to magically make it go away. What are they suggesting?
Right. So their suggestion was to create a statewide community land trust, which I kind of think of as like an HOA where the land is owned by the state and then the houses on top of it are owned by whoever buys them. This kind of hinges on land being donated to the state, so it would have to come from either developers or federal land, things like that. So I think there's a little trickiness in that, I don't know, people don't donate land for no reason, I guess. But yeah, I mean, they said, if you can do that, then you can take off the price of the land from that price of that house. So a 500,000 house may now cost, 100 or 350,000 instead, or that's kind of the example that they gave, which might work. I'm not sure, but it's a suggestion, and they didn't say that these were, answers that are definitely going to play out. They just kind of wanted to get the conversation rolling, is what Natalie told me.
What about the Great Salt Lake? The report I'm quoting from from your story, one issue poses a reputational risk to the state and the Olympics. I guess if millions of visitors visit Utah and the lake's not there, yeah, that would be a big black eye. What are they saying?
Right. Yeah, I think, not even just if it's not there, but just the dust that we've talked about, this toxic that can be blown up from that, and all of the ripple effects that come from the lake drying up is a problem. And the lake is one of the few things that people know about Utah, right? I mean, they know about their parks, the mountains and the snow probably, and then the lake. And so I think that that's what they focused on instead of something like air or some of the other environmental issues that we have. But yeah, so that's what and Natalie was saying. She called it a oh, now I can't remember the word that she used, but a hemispheric issue. So, and yeah, so they are just saying that one of the things that they suggested is giving the lake more water, which we would all like to do. But there were multiple ways that they suggested doing that, ranging from seasonal donations from farmers and other water users so that they can give water to the lake when they're not using it and then be able to keep those rights otherwise. I'm trying to think what some of the other ones were. And then also just basically having and raising water rates, which is not popular, but studies have shown that that would put more water back into the lake. And then, as then Governor Cox also recently this week, I think, came out with a proposal to put $200 million toward the project of refilling the lake by 2034.
Finally, this gets us kind of into a futuristic solution, traffic congestion. What are they suggesting?
Yeah, that's the one that caught my eye. I'm not sure if I'm ready for my car to drive me around. People are doing it, but I'm not sure I'm quite ready for that. But that's what they were talking about, is that having basically starting to rely on autonomous vehicles, which doesn't necessarily mean cars, but can mean cars. It can also mean these air taxis that have been kind of bandied about and are starting to be used a little bit more often for both, human travel and then also packages and things like that. But yeah, so they basically said, let, things will flow faster, traffic will flow faster, there'll be fewer accidents. Everything will be safer if they have autonomous cars that are connected. So that means like they're connected to a computer system, so that system can tell them what lane to be in and when to speed up and when to slow down and what route to take. So basically, it's totally hands off, which is kind of fascinating to me.
And a little scary to me, but
Yeah,
I guess
exactly. But yeah,
if
they
it
say it's safer. Who knows?
yeah but if it comes and a lot of people adopt it, then I'd it's probably be fine. Well, Julie Jagg, thanks for telling us about this.
Thanks for having me on.
Julie Jagg is outdoors reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And coming up following a bit of a break here, we're going to be checking in with reporter Peyton Harkins, and we'll be talking about an unfortunate incident. Utah workers felt sick after an X-ray lab opened next door. Then they checked on the drywall, which was supposed to have been lead-lined. Before we go to a break, bring back in Doc Thurgood. Doc, great to have you with me.
Great to be here with you, Tom.
So, last day of our fall fund drive, and we've been chipping away at this overall goal. We wanted to raise $75,000, chipping away at it, but we're still have ways to go.
Yeah, I think we're about now. We're at, I think $20,000 left.
Okay.
But we also have, so we have this partnership with Post Consumer Brands, where every time we get a donation, they send two boxes of cereal. And that goal, we're actually a lot farther behind. I think we have like 600 boxes that we could still get them to send. So if you are thinking, I don't have a lot of money, I won't be able to donate very much, that donation is still really important to us more than ever, not only because we need the money, but because that will mean two more boxes of cereal. You know, we really want to eke out every last box of cereal we can get from Post Consumer Brands. So even if you're thinking, oh, I can't donate, 100, 200, even if what you can give is just $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever it is, that is going to make a really big difference, especially because we have this challenge going on right now.
So we do have this great challenge. Sonia Manuel DuPont and Ryan DuPont, along with Alberto Brusolara and Luciano Di Cibro, have put up not one match, but two matches. That means your money is tripled, not doubled, but tripled. You kick in $100, that's going to be $300, and so forth and so on. So that is good up into $4,000. We're, Duck, you said we're about halfway
to that? Yeah, a bit
that?
Over halfway to that.
So still got plenty of money there for your money to be tripled, not doubled, but tripled. And at the end of that, we'll bring in $12,000, and that will really help to meet our overall goal. So take advantage of that as well by calling 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, or upr.org. And, of course, we choose these goals carefully. $75,000 is what we chose. In part because we need to make up the money that we have lost from the federal government.
Yes. So as many of you probably already know, we have lost all of the federal funding from the government. CPB is shutting down, which means that every single year we need to make $200,000 more dollars than normal. And that is just going to continue for the foreseeable future, which means that, this drive where UPR is trying to get more money than we normally would because we're trying to essentially, we're trying to replace our biggest sustainer, CPB, with people like you who listen to us to try to get more community support, digging deeper instead of, giving up. That is especially why we love our sustainers, because that means that next year when we're going through this same problem, we still know that we will have your support. That couple of minutes to go online or call us is going to help us, all year into the future. So again, 800-826-1495 or upr.org. Again, 800-826-1495.
And a big thank you. We'll go to break now, and more Behind the Headlines coming up. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Here's the headline. Utah workers felt sick after an X-ray lab opened next door. Then they checked on the drywall, which was supposed to have been lead-lined. We bring in Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins. Peyton, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So, interesting, unfortunate story here. So, where did this happen?
This happened down in St. George. There is it's like a medical, sort of clinic office building. We're all probably pretty familiar with those. And Yeah, Intermountain wanted to open up, a CT lab clinic, which, obviously includes that X-ray machinery. And it was, as is the case in office buildings, next door to other things, in this case, a endocrine and diabetes clinic. So yeah, they chose this spot to put the CT lab in, and had to do some renovations to keep that CT lab safe, such as putting, lead in the drywall, and apparently that did not happen.
So this is normally I'd think of you get a CT scan and go to the hospital, I guess, or but I guess this is for convenience. Have it in a what's this, a strip mall or something?
I don't know that it was a strip mall, but it's
Okay.
just a medical office
An
building,
office building,
just
yeah. Okay.
yeah.
And so if you're in a may say a hospital, I guess you'd have all of that protection, right? A CT scanner does a lot of good, but I guess it puts out some radiation.
Yeah, it uses ionizing radiation to, make the images that it makes. And so it's like, if you're getting a CT scan, you're exposing yourself to some amount of radiation. And I don't, some listeners might have, been near somebody getting some kind of X-ray, and they make you put on the lead, vest to keep you safe and stuff. And so, when you're in an office building like this, you're sharing walls with other clinics, other office spaces. And so they wanted to sort of have a similar shielding, around this room. And, by, this lawsuit contends that Intermountain did, everything it should have done. They contracted with the right people. They had a plan in place to get this room shielded. And for whatever reason, this shielding didn't happen. But the rub here, in addition to that happening, is that, I mean, it took a while to figure out that the shielding wasn't there, because somebody had done testing that said that the shielding was up and working as it should. So there's just multiple, gaps that happen in this story. And the result is that, people who were outside of that CT lab room, such as the people working at that clinic next door, got unduly exposed to radiation. They weren't wearing lead-lined vests. They weren't limiting their time near that room because they thought it was safe. And it turns out that it was emitting enough ionizing, like more ionizing radiation than, Utah code allows businesses to emit on the public. There's different standards for people, that work with radiation. But if you're just a member of the public, you're not supposed to get more than, I think it's 0 point or 0.01, what they call REM, REM, of radiation exposure. And the attorney told me that if somebody had stood outside in the hallway every time there was an exam happening in this CT lab, they would have, for 1 year, standing outside for every exam or every X-ray for 1 year, they'd be exposed to nearly 8 REM, which is, more than that acceptable standard by quite a bit.
Yeah, many, many times more, right? Yeah. So employees at this business next door, the St. George Endocrine and Diabetes Clinic, I guess some of them started feeling sick. How did they notice that something was off?
Yeah, the I forget her actual title. She's, I think, the director of the endocrine and diabetes clinic. She just started noticing that her staff were getting increasingly sick, and the signs of, exposure to radiation are things like, headache, nausea, stuff like that. And so people were apparently just continually experiencing these symptoms. And she started to put two and two together. Even though testing showed that this lab was supposed to be safe, she, just kind of raised a red flag, because, even though they said it was safe, it appeared to not be. And so, then from there, they go through a process to get the lab retested. And as I get to in the story, they eventually just cut a hole in the wall, and they found out that, between these two rooms, instead of there being lead shielding, there was just, what you would expect, drywall and insulation, which, does not do any or much shielding of radiation at all.
So there was it seemed like a subcontractor of a subcontractor kind of it. But anyway, they brought in a company who's supposed to specialize in this. I guess we don't know for sure what happened. They just didn't do the work or.
Yeah, it's that's what I think this lawsuit is trying to uncover, because You have a group that apparently Intermountain had worked with before, medical physics consultants who come up with the shielding plan and then do the testing afterward. And so, when they came and did the testing afterward and found that, there was shielding, the lawsuit, asked the question, did they fabricate those results? Was the testing done improperly? And then, as far as the two people or the two, companies responsible for the construction, it was CRC Construction Inc. And then they got a subcontractor, BNS Drywall, to do the drywall. And the lawsuit alleges that, one of them didn't do what they were supposed to do. It doesn't know which one, but the other sort of wrinkle in this is that, putting in this lead-lined drywall is apparently like 8 to 10 times more expensive than normal drywall. And also just takes more, people power to move it because it's so much heavier, And so the lawsuit alleges that, somebody seems to have gotten unjustly enriched by charging the prices for lead-lined drywall, but not actually putting it in the room. So that's another wrinkle of this lawsuit.
Another part of this is they sent somebody out to test the wall, right? And then that person said it's fine.
Yeah, they said that, the barrier seems to be working as it should and was installed correctly. And it's interesting because apparently the same person, after they, cut the hole in the wall and did, or I don't know actually if the hole in the wall had been cut, but after they'd done other testing that found that the shielding wasn't working, the same tester came back, and there was a line where in the story where the tester was apparently overheard asking where they needed to go to test, which was curious, the lawsuit says, because this person had, already done this testing before, and you assume would have known where to conduct the test. So that was interesting to me.
The very sad and unfortunate result of this is there are several people who received way more radiation than they should have. One person, as you noted, has been diagnosed with leukemia.
Yeah, and that, it's very hard to say if the exposure, to directly link that radiation exposure to this cancer diagnosis, just because as the CDC says, there's a 40% of men and women in the US are going to be diagnosed with cancer at some point. And so it's really hard to pinpoint, sort of the cause when somebody's exposed to excessive radiation like this, but it's still in relatively small amounts. Like, I mean, this wasn't like, you're at the Chernobyl reactor, or something like that. I mean, this was a smaller amount of radiation than a disaster like that. But yeah, I mean, the attorney told me that, one staffer gets exposed to this radiation and then gets a cancer diagnosis. That's scary to everybody. And I believe 27 people were exposed that are named in this lawsuit, and three of those are children. And it's my understanding that at least one of those children in the lawsuit was an unborn baby that was exposed when their mother was pregnant. And so that's just, an extra layer of concern there,
All of these folks who are regularly exposed, I guess they have a higher risk of getting cancer.
So basically, the more you are exposed, the more you are likely to, have some kind of effect from the radiation like cancer. And so, I mean, there's like a this the CDC, says that people who get exposed to less than 10 rem in their lifetime, it'd be hard to figure out like if that's the cause of their cancer. But I mean, it's still concerning, and it's hard. The attorney tells me that it's going to be a really, really long time before we know the full impacts of this exposure, just because, the onset of symptoms for cancer, getting cancer, or whatever. I mean, that takes a while, and who knows what's going on at the cellular level with these people. I mean, radiation damages your cells, it damages your DNA. So, lots of stuff sort of going on way behind the scenes that you wouldn't even know about.
In the meantime, is that CT scanner still operating there?
Yeah, I believe so. I had asked Intermountain about it, and they were unable to tell me over the phone. But I went to the center's website, and they say they're open, Monday through Friday. So
Did
seems like they're open.
they get the lead-lined wall up? Do they have protection now?
I would hope so if they're operating, because the CT lab had to close after, OSHA got involved and found out that the lead-lined wall wasn't there. So I would assume if they're open now, they would have that. But again, Intermountain did not get back to me.
Yeah. Well, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins has been with us. Thank you so much for telling us about this.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Well, it's time for our underplayed stories of the week. Let's start with Robert Gerke. Robert, what's your underplayed story?
There's a story that Carmen Nesbitt posted this morning, based on a legislative hearing yesterday. The former principal of West High told a legislative committee he was subpoenaed and under oath that he feels like he was retaliated against and fired for raising concerns about a stabbing that occurred a couple years earlier. He says that when he raised these, then short time later, the district accused him of letting students graduate improperly, and he was dismissed. The school district didn't respond, but this was kind of a high profile stabbing. Also, he was a well liked principal at the school, and when he was let go, it was a lot of question marks hanging around about it. So you can check that out at sltrib.com.
sltrib.com for that one. Thank you. Outdoors reporter Julie Jagg, what's your underplayed story?
Yeah, I really wanted to bring to light our culture, well, former culture reporter, now an editor and film critic, Sean Means' story about his personal interactions with Robert Redford. Just found it really, really insightful. It gave it kind of a neat other look to who Robert Redford was. And I especially liked the part about Robert Standard Time, because that's sometimes what I run on. So, but just check it out. It's a lot of fun little vignettes in there.
Great. Check that out at sltrib.com as well. Peyton Harkins, what's your underplayed story?
My underplayed story comes from Courtney Tanner. She did a deep dive into the impacts in the Navajo Nation after EF2 tornado ripped through there earlier this month. And, I'm somebody from Oklahoma. I'm very familiar with tornadoes, and we don't get them very much in Utah. And one thing I know about them is that if they hit where you're at, no matter how big or small they are, it leaves a big impact. And I think Courtney did a great job of talking to all those people who had their lives changed in significant ways by this, crazy weather phenomenon. And the photos are wild too. So I would recommend everybody check that out.
SLTrib.com for that one as well. All the stories we've been talking about. Well, we've been talking behind the headlines with Salt Lake Tribune political reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Have a good weekend.
Have a good weekend, yes. Salt Lake Tribune Outdoors reporter Julie Jagg has been with us. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Pleasure for us as well. And Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins has been with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with us again next time. Before we end the program for good, we're going to turn to Doug Thurgood again. Some important news on this last day of the fall fund drive.
Yes, it is the very last day of our fall fund drive. You only have about 9 hours left until it ends. So if you've been thinking that you want to support UPR and support public media and everything that we do, this is the time. You will not have tomorrow to do it. So your gift now is what's going to make this drive a success. We've had a really great morning. We've had a lot of really wonderful people calling in and going to the website to donate. Garrett Van Langdeveld, who did it on behalf of our cats, Panther, Panther and Iris, their dog Roo, and our parakeet Kiwi. Very sweet. Thank you so much. Also Cookie, who donated, and Bonnie Scholes. We've had stuff all over the state, from Logan, Mendon, South Jordan, Oatman, St. George, a whole bunch of different places. So we've really appreciated the real outpouring of love we've gotten this whole week, and especially this morning. Very happy that we got all of that love during Behind the Headlines, which I know Tom was really hoping for. But if you are one of those people who has not given yet, now is the time. Do it while you're thinking about it. Go to upr.org or call 800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495.
Our overall goal is $75,000 at the beginning of the drive. We've chipped away at that. I think, Doug, about 20,000 ish away.
Yeah, a little less than 20,000 now.
Yeah, so we began the day 30,000 ish. So you can see we've made great progress. Let's keep that going. You might think, wow, $20,000 the rest of the day. We've done that before. And
absolutely,
with your help, we'll do it again. It's, you know, we don't just pick those goals willy-nilly. It's what we need to help to raise our regular money and then to help make up for this $200,000 gap in federal funding that we've lost as well.
Yes. You know, the CPB, we say, was our biggest sustainer. And with losing that, we're now turning to people like you, people who, you know, maybe have listened to us for years or maybe are new to us, people who just care about public media and having access to, you know, the news and the programs and the emergency alerts that we offer, things that only we can offer. You can call 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, or go to upr.org. Now is truly the time. There are 9 hours left of this fund drive. So if you're thinking about it right now, this is the moment to call or to go online.
And your money's tripled, not doubled, but tripled, up to $4,000. We're about halfway through that. So have your money tripled today at 800-826-1495 or upr.org. And thank you.